The Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands of millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is day 4 of this 7-day session, the first of 2018 at Mountain Gate in northern New Mexico. Here it is January, although very unusual January. Yesterday was almost 60 degrees. This morning there was a little light covering of snow on the ground, mostly frost really, and it's close to 50 this afternoon. Very bizarre. But life is change, and it's challenging for people who have difficulty with change. But our practice can make a big difference. I'd like to continue sharing with you today and commenting on this book called Unbinding, The Grace Beyond Self by Kathleen Dowling Singh, who died earlier, earlier this year, but this year has only started. She died last year. And her autobiography says she was old enough to get Medicare, and she was a mother, grandmother, and lived in Sarasota, Florida. She was a transpersonal psychologist, and transpersonal psychology allows the possibility of transcendent states of mind. And she was also a very long time spiritual practitioner and was able to navigate multiple different spiritual traditions. She mainly worked in Buddhism, and she also, as part of her psychology work, did a lot of work with hospice patients, was very active in hospice, and her first book was called The Grace in Dying. Grace being her term for what in many different traditions has a term. Christianity and Judaism, it's called God. In the Islam religion, it's called Allah. And in Zen, it's called Buddha nature. It doesn't matter what we call it, and in fact, it is beyond words. She calls it grace. So we've already started working our way through this book, and now I'd like to pick up, still early on in it. This is a chapter on the Four Noble Truths, but I think pretty much all of you know the Four Noble Truths. The first one being that life is characterized by something that's been translated as suffering, but suffering is not a sufficient translation. It's also been termed pervasive dissatisfactoriness. And it can range all the way from discomfort, slight discomfort, boredom, ennui, to profound agony. And hopefully it's the first set of characteristics or range of characteristics that we're afflicted by. But nonetheless, anyone who comes to Zen practice has some sense of the truth of that first noble truth, that there is discomfort in our lives. And the second noble truth is that discomfort comes as a result of clinging to various things, attachment to, in particular, a sense of self. And that sense of self really is mythical. It doesn't exist. The self itself does not exist, but we think it does, and we think it does permanently and fixed. And we do our best to defend it and to uphold it and to keep it going. There's a constant stream of thoughts traveling through our minds. not all of it making much sense. Fragments of conversation, bits of music. We may have heard a line out of a movie, and just some inner commentary. And yet we keep it going at a subtle level because it makes us feel like we exist. Descartes said, "I think, therefore I am." And he nailed it. But if we're not thinking, then what? There's a rather deep place we can reach in our practice where we can actually choose whether to enable a thought to arise. This is different from suppression. This is different from the traditional term of cutting thoughts. It's a simple choice not to bring forth a thought. Thinking is a tool. It also can, in the form of actual talk, be a mode of communication. It's certainly not the only mode of communication. Our bodies communicate with other bodies, with life itself, in ways that we may or may not be even a little bit conscious of, but it's actually been measured scientifically. And those of us who are sensitive understand it deeply. We feel it. It's known that people can feel each other's feelings. And as a matter of fact, for a long time, I didn't realize that what I was feeling was not my feelings, but that I was picking up other people's feelings. And it's important to learn to differentiate and not get caught in other people's feelings, or our own for that matter, but to see a deeper place and to empathize when people are sad or frustrated or angry or whatever. We've all felt all of those feelings. And not to fall back into a self-defense mode, because this self is a figment of our imagination. The third noble truth is that there's a way out of this pervasive dissatisfactoriness. We can become free of what causes it. And then the fourth noble truth, of course, is the way out, the Eightfold Noble Path, which involves, among other things, right view, which is clear seeing, that comes forth from deep zazen. And that's what we're about here, is deep zazen and becoming free of the machinations of these illusions that make us believe that we are certain people with certain characteristics, and that those characteristics have to be defended, and that we get insulted and we get embarrassed and we get angry as a result, or we get frustrated, or we get sad, or we take it inward and feel that mythical knife in our chest. So to begin with, she writes, "In this book, we will work with particular practices, inquiry leading to insight, leading to spontaneous surrender." And that's exactly what we do in our zazen. We search deeply for who we are. We search exploring our mind, moving beyond thoughts, ideas, impressions, assumptions, reaching for something deeper, more clear, more true. And through that, little by little, we gain insight. And as we gain sufficient insight, we begin to surrender our assumptions, our attachments. We let go little by little, more and more of our clinging, and become more and more free. Inquiry is a focused mind committed to creating the meditative equipoise that can see. Insight is a realization seen and known, and surrender is a renunciation of previous attachment and identification, a release of ignorance. With a commitment to seeing the truth of how things are, we follow a path of wise view, of penetrating understanding of the universal causal factors of the separate self-sense. The teachings on dependent arising illuminate the attention-trapping web created in the interplay of these causal factors. With wise views, with recognition, the web is unraveled in the seeing. The less we believe in the illusions created within the unconscious conditions of life in form, the conditions of dependent arising, the less our attention is trapped within the paradigm they create and within the assumptions and unease of the paradigm. Once we see through the illusion, we no longer assent to it. When we see through, and it's not one illusion, it's aspects of the illusion of self. So we gain insight little by little into certain aspects of our behavior, of our assumptions, of our ideas. And in gaining insight, we see the instability, we see the falsity of these assumptions. And we can no longer believe in them because we've seen through them. And they're let go. And that allows deeper seeing and more letting go. It's a long process. And it's important not to get caught up in measuring, in judging, any of it. And yet we do. And that's a source of more pain and suffering. That is actually a reinforcement of a sense of self. So be careful. As we begin to see through our behavior, don't turn around and be filled with regret and remorse and sadness and pain. Be glad it's let go. Don't attach to the results. Don't attach to the past. It all has to be let go of in order to be free, really. Of course, we have some remorse at how we've behaved or how we've been caught in our suffering or in our assumptions about ourselves. But be careful that we don't create a new identity with that. This is vital. Once we see through the illusion, we no longer assent to it. It's like watching a great magician perform his pièce de résistance. We marvel, we're stunned with what we believe we see. And then when the secret is revealed, we can see the illusion as illusion, perhaps still enjoying it, but no longer believing it or clinging to it. The distance between enjoying and clinging can be measured in light years. In the great transformative shift that arises after seeing through illusion, the egoic sense of self, once so defended, becomes available for a joyful surrender. No one needs the burden, the confinement. The truth of the path carries us out of the tight and binding grip of self, out of samsara, and directly to the recognition of grace as our own essential nature. It frees us to know, experience, and abide in the ever-deepening realizations of the vastness of being with a capital B. And again, this is not a one-shot deal. This is a work in progress. And that we've even stepped onto that path is significant. So don't hang on to whether you should have done it earlier, whether you shouldn't have been caught to begin with, whether you shouldn't have done whatever you did out of the ignorance that you now see. There's no point in that. Why pile ignorance on top of ignorance? Why pile suffering on top of suffering? The next chapter is called The Conditions of Self. And it is, here she takes out what's called the codependent arising or codependent origination, the path through which we find ourselves attached to the self-image. And as we see through even part of it, we begin to become free. It's something very much worth studying. But before that, she says, over time, I've come to see that our experiential realization of these teachings of dependent arising depends upon three things. The first has to do with contemplation, clear seeing. And that is what we do in the Zendo. Without clear seeing, without this inward deepening search for the truth, there's no other avenue out of this sense of self that is so tenacious, so seemingly fixed, so a source of suffering. On occasion, one can hear of what one would call spontaneous awakening. But it's not really spontaneous. It comes out of a deep search, a transformation. There's no such thing as suddenly popping into enlightenment without some work going on beforehand. And in our tradition, we have tools for doing that work, very effective tools for doing that work. And we have this wonderful Zendo. We have this wonderful mountain gate where we can gather together as Sangha, supporting each other in this practice of becoming more free, opening to our innate compassion and wisdom, and more able to live it without hindrance. The first has to do with contemplation, clear seeing, our deep penetration of the workings of these mutually influencing conditions, that's the dependent arising, both in our own long-term and momentary experience of life leads to realization. Although our tendency is to continue to try to find fulfillment within these conditions, in reality we recognize that we're playing a losing game. And that's what brings us here. To work hard to step out of it. There was I think it was Isaac Asimov story long, long time ago that I read about a rocket ship that crash landed on some planet. And the crash was sufficient that it made the rocket ship unrepairable. And so the two couples who were the astronauts inside chose to clone themselves in miniature and place themselves, these miniatures, in the only thing that was around on that planet, which was a series of little puddles. And being miniature, they could survive in the puddles. A miniature, and I suppose they had some ability to survive in water. It doesn't say more about how this was affected, but so these miniature astronauts are living in this puddle, and they begin to wonder what's outside the puddle. And there are miniature weeds growing in the puddle, and they decide to climb up one of the weeds and see what's outside the puddle. And they get to the top, and the surface tension of the water is extreme, particularly for someone who's miniature. But they finally pop out. And that's, of course, where the story ends. Presumably, they're going off to explore. There is that surface tension within our practice. We struggle to keep the focus. We struggle to deepen the practice despite wanting to do sometimes anything but being pulled by all the wonderful things that seem so amazingly wonderful when we're sitting in the Zendo. Of course, they don't seem quite as wonderful when we get out of the Zendo and Sesshin is over, but Makyo can be incredibly beguiling. And it's something of a struggle. We stay up late and get tired. We get discouraged sometimes and feel it's hopeless. Stuff comes up, our histories, and sometimes hijacks us. Our imagination takes flight and creates all kinds of amazing scenarios to attempt to draw us away. There's a lot of stuff going on, fighting all of our attempts to focus deeply. But we gain strength each time we resist. Or if we can't resist it, we return to the practice after getting sidetracked. It makes a huge difference. Gradually we grow deeper. Gradually we begin to gain some insight and then gain more insight. And keeping going little by little, we shed our attachments. It takes a long time before we can shed sufficiently to be truly free, but we can certainly get glimpses of that state that is inherent in us along the way. And if we persist, we will become truly free. Persistence is vital. It's one of the three pillars of Zen, considered to be essential to Zen practice. Of course, if you don't persist, how are you going to realize that freedom? And each time you encounter some force of resistance, each time you encounter some distraction and choose to instead refocus the mind on the practice and search deeper, it strengthens the practice, it weakens the attachments. And your practice can continue to deepen in incredible ways. So, she talks about three things that are experiential realization, the teachings of dependent origination depend on. And the first, of course, is contemplation, as she said. And then the second, she says, has to do with self-surrender. Our willingness to let go of our entrapment in an endless cycle that holds no lasting promise of peace or awakening. That's part of the difficulty in our practice. The habit patterns of mind, the tenacity of the self-image is very strong. We kind of would like to keep it and be freed at the same time. And that's not possible. So as part of our practice, we really need to both see and surrender to the seeing and give up what we are able to see through. Let go this tenacious, persistent, pernicious self-image and the habit patterns that have been generated over lifetimes that create greed, anger, and delusion and keep us trapped. We can be free. We're already working in that direction. Sesshin has been very deep. And it's important to keep it going that way. Surrender is a vital aspect of our practice. Daring to let go. Daring to step out of our comfort zone. Surrender involves more than simply the willingness to let go of any thoughts that's been tugging at us, for example, although it certainly includes that. Surrender has to do with releasing our attachment to and identification with thought, with the mind's wanderings in general, except as conceptuality and mental operations serve a useful, practical, additive function. Surrender is the emptying of the mind, the emptying of its beliefs and fabrications, especially the fabrication of the I illusion, the me. Most of the thousands of thoughts flying through our minds each day have no value. Most are mistaken based on ignorance. Unmindful, they're in service to the paradigm of self. The willingness to surrender them arises from discernment as to which have benefit and which do not, as well as from disenchantment with the illusions ignorance creates. The willingness to surrender operates in service to awakening. The third factor upon which our realization depends is grace. Our realizations depend upon the intensity with which grace arises in us. And grace has arisen already, or we wouldn't be here. We all have some sense that there is something beyond this place, this life of periodic pleasure and frequent pain. And that is the bubbling up of a sense of our true nature. Our realizations depend upon the intensity with which grace is arising in us, the openness we have to making room for it through self-surrender, and the transformational practices of contemplation and meditation. All three, contemplation, surrender, and grace, condition each other in ways that lead toward conscious communion in the sacred nature of reality. All three bring the insights of the teachings to our heart's understanding. And then she gets into her translation of The Penitent Arising. And that's a lot to undertake right now. So we'll work on that tomorrow. In the meantime, keep diving. Keep diving. Recognize that the work is being done and it's significant, and that you keep doing it, and freedom will open to you. As surely as Hakuin would have said, you can't miss the ground when you stamp your foot. He also talked about straightforward bravery, which is vital as well. To face where we're caught, some of it painful, some of it frightening, to to allow ourselves to feel the sensations in our body and dive deep within, reaching beyond words for the truth of our very being. We all have this capacity. We're all well on our way to realizing it. So I thank you for listening. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.